Welcome to episode 14, part one of Your Hearth at Home. My name is Tara, and I am so grateful that you are here. This week's offering is going to be different than what you're used to on this show. This week, we have the pleasure of hearing Ali Olshan's story. To give you a preview, Ali was born in the Soviet Union to black and white parents. He escaped racism in Ukraine, crossing borders undocumented and claiming refugee status four times in Germany and the United States of America. He is now a permanent resident living in the US with full status and is a proud US patriot. I first connected with Ali indirectly through a mutual friend, and we instantly clicked. He was ready to tell his story, and I was so grateful for the opportunity to listen. When we connected, I shared with him what this podcast show is about: self-love, coming home to self, growth, and healing. And within this context, he was drawn to speak to moving out of victim mindset and how much healing and growth can come from this. His story and his path, as you will hear, has been filled with rejection and trauma. And it is so inspiring to hear all that he has been through and where he is now through shifting out of that victim mentality time and time again. So I invite you to join me on Your Hearth at Home's first series. This whole series was recorded in one take. Ali spent over 3 hours recounting his experiences and his journey. And I would really like to start by honoring what it takes to revisit painful experiences and the gift of sharing this wisdom that it may help and inspire others on their path. One chapter of Ali's story will be released every 2 days. So please settle in and listen to a story of strife and triumph. Let Ali take you on a journey to experience what it was like to walk his path from consistently living in survival mode to a spiritual awakening. I hope that you enjoy. Welcome back to Your Hearth at Home. I am so extremely grateful to be here with Ali Olshan today. He is someone who I connected with, who just came into my sphere, and I'm so very grateful to be able to share this space with you. Thank you for being here today.
Thank you for having me. Thank you.
I'm really excited. We've spoken and you've got an incredible story to share, and I'm really excited just to turn it over to you and to build some context around how you've come to where you are today.
Yes, absolutely. Well, it's been a rough but humbling life journey, and it still is. And when you are constantly in the moment, you forget to reflect on the past. So I'm very thankful for you to enabling this opportunity to go back and dive into the past, which has been very turbulent and painful, but also there is a lot of positives that take out of it. So I was born in Kyiv, Ukraine, to a father from Tanzania, and my mother is from Rokcha, which is in Siberia. My father was part of the first Africans who came to study to Ukraine, specifically in Soviet Union, in late 70s. And my mom, that's a separate story, but she was born in camps, in Gulag camps in Siberia. And eventually her parents were able to escape her from there. One of her parents died, and then another died, and then she was adopted eventually. And basically, she was settled in Ukraine. So they met in Ukraine, and that's where I was born in 1987. So their connection, their wedding was looked upon as something abnormal at the time. It was scrutinized a lot, and my father, my mom also had a child from another man, and so my father, who is an African man, he was raising my older sister, who is white and blonde, and people had a hard time understanding this because it was so unusual. And in Soviet Union, the reason why Soviet Union brought a lot of students from Africa is because they were obviously spreading communism, but also there was a big propaganda of bringing people together from different races. So even though my father will be called, you know, over there, nigger is a normal word in Soviet Union. That's how you taught in schools. He was totally okay with it because there were other people that were called the same way. And during Soviet Union era, he was not physically attacked or discriminated. It was mostly verbal. Because Soviet Union practiced very strong police force, and I mean, I spoke with him recently when I was in Africa about this, and he said he felt way safer in Soviet Union before it collapsed. When it collapsed, it just turmoil. And this is when I was born. I was born 1987, and in 1991, Soviet Union completely collapsed, and that. You can feel there was a shift. There was a shift in political structure. There was also a shift in just whole geopolitics of Soviet Union, where all of the sudden everything became privatized and divided. It gave place to a lot of nationalistic organizations, neo-Nazis organizations, and all of a sudden we started having skinheads. I have not experienced any skinheads until I was 8-9 years old, so we're talking about 1995-1996. It was shaping after the Soviet Union collapsed, but in 1995, so my father, one of the biggest incidents is that starting 1990s, there were way more attacks on Africans for the base of their skin, race. There were thought that there was a assumption that they had money or anything else. So they were attacked. One of my father's friends from Ethiopia actually died in the metro subway station. Basically told, get out of the country, you are filthy, this. So all of a sudden, there was a lot of this negativity that just came. Maybe it piled up. Also, the country was in crisis, so the poverty hit. And I will speak from my personal experience, because I did see other Africans suffering. When my father in 1995, when I was 8 years old, my father was attacked heavily by skinheads when coming back from conference. So he was still studying. He was doing PhD in, he had to finish his PhD in engineering. And one of the nights he was heavily attacked and robbed right in front of my mom's eyes. And there was a gas pistol involved. They put some cover up and they shot him. He was able to get away. It was just gas to sort of neutralize him, not kill him, just neutralize him. But it's something that I did not see. I was on this side of the apartment. There is a door and he was right there. He was yelling, screaming. We called ambulance afterwards, and ambulance really didn't do much. They were afraid themselves because the country was ruled by mafia at the time. So this is when my father developed major anxiety and post-traumatic stress. And he said he has to go to Africa. He has to flee. Also, his mother was not feeling well, which she later passed away. So he fled, and I stayed with my mother. It's just me, just my mother, me, and my older sister. My older sister was already married, so it was just me and my mother. And my father promised us that he will take me to Africa, go to school. But we lost connection with him. We were only at the time, 1995, communication was just not working. There was no Skype, there was no means of communicate. We had to go to the payphone, pay crazy amounts of dollars. And I mean, I'm not coming from a rich family. We were like lower middle class, I would say, just barely surviving. And there was this fear, because my father did not want me to go to school, because he knew what will happen, that I will be offended in school. And my mom said she could not wait, because we lost contact. All we know that Tanzania, there was some civil war going on in Rwanda, and the country was in poverty. The Tanzania in the late 90s was in complete poverty. They didn't have consistent electricity, and we didn't even know what happened, where he went. So my mom brought me to school, and the first day in the school, I was poked at. I was, there was this joke that I will never forget. So in Russian, it's Russian, ты хуёво покрашен, which means Russian, you are painted they painted you very badly, like very fucking badly. They painted you to be looking like Russian. And so that was stuck in my head. And then next day over, I was shot in the toilet. Backpack was thrown outside of the window. And I felt so helpless. The fact that the school system over there, it's not just secondary school, middle school, high school. You have kids from middle school and high school in the same school. So you can have, I was bullied mostly by guys that are 15 years old, 16 years old, that were not even supposed to be in the school, but the school system there is very, very different. And the classmates, my grandmother, because my mom had to go work, my grandmother will come, she tried to fight for me, adopted grandmother. She had to fight for me, and she said, Ali, you know, you cannot go to school. And I said, I will not go to school again. And so my mom came, she tried to explain something to teacher. There was a lot of tears and stress, because someone tried to like see my dick in the toilet, if it's black or this, you know. There was a lot of this, there was no sexual violence, but there was just this laughing at and figuring out if I'm, you know, just like mocking me for the skin color. And I didn't really understand where it comes from. I just felt like, goodness, my father promised me to go to Africa. So I was dreaming that I will escape this reality. But I was brought home. My mom took me home, and I was homeschooled. So this is 1995. I'm 8 years old. Occasionally, she will try to see if I can go back to school, because we could not afford homeschooling, and there was no homeschooling system in place. So, I mean, she will read me things, but then she says, Ali, we don't have it. I don't know. I can try teaching you. You can read books. And we had some private tutor come in, and my older sister was helping with that financially. But then next year, mom said, no, we have to put you back to school. It's just, we cannot afford it. So she puts me back to school, and I was going through the same thing. Just a little bit more physical this time, just saying, oh, why did I come back? Like, am I trying to revenge and this? And I just tried to go to school. So I came back home in tears. I said, I'm not going to go to school. So at the my secondary school education was pretty much non-existent. I tried to study at home. The only thing I had motivation to study was English language, because my father told me it's important to study English. We were once a German colony, we were an English colony. That sort of stuck in my mind, and I remember reading Scrooge McDuck. I don't know how they smuggled it to Ukraine back then, but I had a Scrooge McDuck thing, not books, but just like journals, magazines, and then Donald Duck. And I had this sort of vision that eventually I'll get out of this reality, but I didn't know how. So this was my childhood, and where I grew up in the neighborhood in Ukraine. Thankfully, I had some friends that were understanding what it is to be like me, and they were more so friendly. If I will go outside of the neighborhood, my mom will not let me be outside of the vicinity much, especially when I was young. So that this is my early stages. And then when I in 2001, there was few attacks on me that I sent you on email in a refugee case. It's kind of hard for me to go back in each of one of them. But after one of the incidents when I was attacked with a metal rod by skinheads, this was year 2000, late 2000, 2001. My mom said, we have to find a way out, because I was bleeding. I mean, I still have like my arm cracks here. So it's something that cannot be fixed. It always has this crack. Because it was dislocated. My mom said, we have to escape Ukraine. There has to be a way to completely find a way to escape. So she applied for a visa to Germany, because we found out that there is a way to get refugees. My mom had a friend who applied for political asylum in Germany. So she said, this will be the way out, and your son will be able to go to school. So she applied for a visa, she got rejected. She got rejected because, you know, immigration sees a woman, and I also have younger sister. My younger sister was born 1995, so she was mostly home. My mom didn't want her to experience none of this, so she was put home. My mom applied for immigration to Germany, got visa rejection, and then she started looking for alternative ways out of Ukraine. This time around, we had to resort to my older sister, because she had connections with people at the border. So you have to bribe mafia to sneak you through the borders. So there was an organized van that will take us to the border, and then we will have to go and change. I was 2001. I was 13 years old, and my younger sister was around 6 years old. So all three of us, we make it to the border, and then we have to change from van to a semi-truck. So we hide underneath the pallets in semi-truck. And how it works, if anyone is interested in a border transportation, trafficking, is when there are people that are semi-truck drivers who are checked not as thoroughly, because they go so much back and forth. So they're like on a green list. And if you pay them more, you have more chance to sneak through the border. Whereas if you pay somebody who doesn't go as often, they are not whitelisted, the risk is higher. So to cross the borders was $5,000. So mom had to sell grandma's apartment. And I mean, at the time, I think it was I don't remember the prices and inflation, but it was just enough to go and make it to Germany. So, you know, just you can imagine when you go through the border, you hear the dogs, you hear everything, you just you have these little buckets to pee, like bottles if you want to pee, and it's just very intense. And thankfully my younger sister, she didn't have awareness. She's 6 years old. All she knows is that we're going on a trip, and we have to be quiet because there are dogs. So it was just, and I don't know why I treated this as some sort of computer game, some simulation, because it didn't seem like it's real. Thankfully, we crossed Polish-Ukrainian border, and then there is Ukrainian-Polish border, which was the most intense, because this is where you have people from Afghanistan cross there, you have people from Iraq, you have many refugees being stuck in Ukraine because either they didn't bribe somebody, or they didn't pay somebody off, or someone ripped them off. There is a lot of reasons why people get stuck in one country or another, and they cannot make it to Germany, everyone tries to make it as far as they can, like Sweden, Norway, where you have more benefits, but it's almost impossible because they're so far away, and the logistics of it only allow you to get maybe 2-3 borders. So which is Germany was the closest one. It's like you cross one border another. And then once we crossed it, the Polish-German border was pretty much non-existent because it's already Schengen, which is like part of European Union. Obviously, at the time, I didn't know none of that. I'm just telling you from the perspective now. But once we crossed there was already another van awaiting for us in Dresden, I believe. And that took us all the way to the western side of Germany, because we were told if you apply in the western side of Germany, they're more accepting of refugees, and it's away from the wall. There are still some pre-notions that if you live closer to the Berlin Wall, it's more intense there, and they're still rebuilding infrastructure of East Germany. So we tried to go to the West Germany, and once we got to the West Germany, one of my mom's friends, she met us. She says, "Well, I'm so thankful that you guys got there. It's so good." And this is when we applied for political asylum. Basically, all I had to do is go. Yeah, it was me. So we went to the train station. It was Kaiserslautern, I think. And we said Azul. Azul is like asylum. And we had police escort us to refugee center, and this is when the application began. We applied, my sister, me and mom, we had some luggage, we had some foreigners help us carry the luggage, and then we applied. My mom had to go through a long, grueling 2-3 hour interview, why you're applying, why you cannot go back, what did your son experience. So she went through those interviews herself, and she came so stressed, so depressed. She said, "You know, we already made it here, but I'm so humiliated with all these questions." And because over there, nobody trusts anybody. Immigration doesn't trust anybody. Everyone has some sort of story. A lot of people lie. A lot of refugees claim to be from one country, but they're from another to get status. It's just people trying to survive any way possible. So when we were placed in this little refugee camp, it was basically a shipyard, a big ship, somewhere in a very industrial area, probably used to be industrial ship. It stank there. It didn't smell healthy, but we were at least given food. There was breakfast, there was lunch. We were placed in the in a room with another family, and we slept, you know, I had to sleep with my mom on the same bed because there wasn't much space. My sister was like tucked between us. So it was just, it felt safer. I'll say it felt safer for me. It's just very new and unknown environment where you don't even know what's going to go next. So after a bunch of interviews with my mom, after maybe 7 days, we were transported to another camp, another refugee camp. So they put us on a train, and this was the first time I experienced like a real Europe. Like, you are on a train, there you have to like buy a card. This, I mean, they pay for everything, but you see everything in process, how it's happening in civilized world. And yeah, we were transported to another refugee camp. There is more stories there from one camp to another, but we were basically put in many different camps before they put us in the more permanent camp. I mean, my desire was to at least try to go back to school, and my sister go to kindergarten, because she needs to learn something. And so eventually, after bouncing us from one camp to another, there was many stories in those different camps, the conditions we were in. We were put in Kutel, which is Essen. And it was more so, we call it temporary permanent camp. So they give us this 6 months extension, which means for 6 months, nothing's going to happen. We can stay. And this is when I started applying for any sort of school, like any school. And I went to school. I was accepted to school. My mom started going to a church. She's a Christian. She's Pentecostal. And there was a service that will pick her up and take her to the church on Sundays. And other than that, the refugee camp by itself was like this long white container, which is very hot in the summer and cold in the winter. Doesn't have any insulation. It's just like completely, the refugees are packed. The environment is very intense because we had four showers for about 400 or 500 people, and you have four or three bathrooms. Yeah, four toilets, and that was all shared. And it was all like dirty and stinky, and people had to sometimes fight over showers because, you know, you have refugee from Afghanistan and another refugee from Albania, and, you know, they're just escaping a war, and you see the fights, you see like physical misunderstandings of languages, you see violence, and you're like, you know, I experienced violence myself before that, and now I see violence. Thankfully, my younger sister was mostly home. I had to go to grocery stores. I had to go do things. I picked up German very quick so I could talk with the refugee center, they call Hausmeister, the guy who is in charge of refugee camp. So I was doing all the communications for my mom if there were some misunderstandings. And then the kids, you have family, like Albanian families that over there, they had like 9 kids. So all these kids running around there, they escaped the war and they try to challenge you. So I had to fight there with those kids because something didn't click, or they didn't understand me, or they just didn't like the way I look. I had no idea what they were saying in Albanian. I don't know if this is racism or not, but I didn't even know what it was about. It was just about dominance, who is stronger. So I said, Mom, I need to. So I found a way to register at school myself at the age of 14. I talked to the refugee organizer, the guy who runs the camp. He just gave me a few places. He said, well, not every school accepts refugees, you just have to find a good school. There is like different levels of school. There is gymnasium. So I got accepted in a school that is almost one below gymnasium. They believe that I can pull it off. So the moment I accepted to school, it was such It was such blessing. I felt, wow, this is how kids should be. This is how the system, this is how it just should be in reality. You know, like I arrived to the school and I was given this card, the Schulausweis, which allows me to use the public transportation for free. I see the kids from different cultures. I see kids from Albania, from Africa, and they're all like working together. They're all learning German. And I was first put in this class that allowed me to study German. So before you go take math or science or anything else, you have to be in this German class for about 3-4 months, 5 months, depending how quickly you pick up. So that class, I took extended classes. Like I stayed in school from the earliest to the latest. Like I wanted to be there. I wanted to be part of something. And that's when I realized you have to be part of something where you are accepted. Because for the most part, there was a lot of rejection when you grow up. There's just rejection, 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 rejection. And you become old, you become mature very quick, very quick. You feel like you're aging so quickly with fatigue. And the school gave me this new life, gave me life to study something, gave me opportunity to just open my eyes and see that I can be friendly. Of course, I was distrustful of teacher. I didn't trust anybody because I didn't know how to develop any trust issues. Trust doesn't exist, does not exist. Like the definition of not trusting was engraved. And so I'm going to school and the teacher was so educated, Hans Ake, great teacher. He spoke French, German, Russian. He lived in Russia, so he understood where I'm come from, and he was so warm towards me. He was so, like, this was one of the first person, besides one of the people at the refugee camp who took my mom to church, who was also very nice. This was one of the first people that were very warm and welcoming. Just gave me the hope that I can, that I'm worthy of something, that I can be studying and accepted. One second. Just... So I'm going to school and I'm learning German. I'm picking up very quick. German became my life. Like everything, I came back to a refugee camp. And I refused to speak to my mom in Russian. I refused to speak to my sister in Russian. I wanted to forget everything that has to do with the past. It went so extreme. I probably became racist towards that language because that's where I got the pain from. And I was forcing everybody in the refugee camp that I talked to, because what's interesting, the people that live in our refugee camp, you know, my mom's neighbor was a woman from Baghdad. And then there was a bunch of people from Syria. There was a woman from Senegal and many other countries. And they developed their own version of German. Like they will say, you know, Kef, like, how are you, which is Arabic. And then they will say Habari or something. You know, it's just, they will mix a lot of different languages together, and they will not be a proper German. So when I came, that made me mad because I'm like, you know, you're in Germany, you have to find a way to integrate. But that's my picture because I was going to school and they don't have anywhere to go. The refugees over there, who else gonna talk to them? They are stuck in the camp. I had an ego and I felt like finally I'm liberating, and I was just forcing. I will not speak Russian. I'll just speak German and say, if you want to talk to me, that's all you have to do. So those were the first few years, first year I was going to school. I was actually first time I was able to get into German normal school. So I was able to graduate the German classes and go and take subjects like math and everything else, physics. And I realized how much I'm lacking in my knowledge. But people towards me in that class, which was more German, there were like lots of people from Turkey, but it was mostly German, they were very friendly towards me. I mean, even then I realized how much more kids in Germany are more tolerant towards other racists, and how I was accepted. I don't remember being called like N-word, like none of the Negro stuff, Nieger, like there was that words just sort of vanished, because that's how they're taught and the school system is great. And I felt accepted. Like I knew that I was lacking behind, but the teacher Beckers was there. It was a very good German teacher. He taught me some Hochdeutsch, which is German version, like Southern German version, like higher German. And so I really tried my best. Like I was integrating into society as much as I can. Like I will be hanging out with Germans, mingle here and there with foreigners, and then still keep in touch with the class, with the German class, the foreigner class that had a bunch of refugees in there as well. So I was just, things were working for me. But then what was not working is that the German immigration started decreasing our extension. So they were giving 6 months visa and then another 6 months, and then they gave 3 months. And then there is this thing called a rejection letter, which they send and you have to hire a lawyer. And this is when my mom, so after first 6 months in Germany, we got this rejection letter saying that we don't see enough proof that you can stay in Germany. And also this is when 9/11 happened. So 2001, 9/11 happens, and our refugee camps began flooded with refugees. If I said it was intense at the beginning, it got way more intense. I remember we had just families just dropped off and they put them all in containers. And so I'm coming back from school one day and I see like so many more new people, just more people, and you don't know what to tell them. I was already speaking German. So I started helping, especially Africans, because I spoke English as well. And those Africans that spoke English, I'll help them to go get grocery stores, like even put a penny in a cart so that they can get a cart. So there are a lot of these nuances. So I became just so involved into their lives. I mean, I started skipping school. The school didn't like the fact that I'm, you know, they sent letters to my mom. My mom doesn't know how to read these letters. They're like, Ali, just go to school, do whatever you can. And then so some of the refugees needed me to help translate them, take them all the way to the city center to get their paperwork done. So I was just so involved. And then on top of this, getting groceries for her mom because she was in so distress. There was a lot of alcohol there where she was. There were some other refugees. They started drinking because the reality was so sad. And then one time I got caught in the grocery store. The policeman actually caught me and he said, "You should be in school." He said, "You should go to school. Like you, they have their lives." And then the school received a notice from one of the security in the store that I'm not in school. So it was a shame for me. And I said, "I'm sorry. I was just lost." So I resumed the school. I kept my focus on the school, but I was still stressed at the fact that my mom had to hire a lawyer. So all the social money that we were getting from the system, which was at the time. So at the time, the German Deutschmark changed to euro. So the whole European Union started adopting euros. And my mom had to pay about 200 to 300 euros a month to a lawyer just to extend our stay, because there were so many refugees and they didn't see a case of racism in Ukraine. They're like, we don't see it, because in Ukraine it was silenced. The Ukrainian media, they were trying to little by little make moves towards Europe, and they had to silence everything, newspapers, there was nothing. And they said, well, there are, when my mom went back to the immigration office, they said, we have people from Afghanistan, we have people from Iraq, they're escaping war. What is it? You have a war in Ukraine? That doesn't mean anything. So visa got reduced month to month. And then it got to the point she had to go every 2 weeks, she had to go and renew it. She was so stressed, and obviously that stress came upon me, and I felt like, and it was pretty much 1 month before finishing school. She said, she sat down and said, Ali, I cannot do this anymore. I cannot every week I have to go and humiliate myself to beg for extension of the refugee. We have to find a way to go some other place. She had a chance to go to France. There was some refugee caravan going to France, and she said, we can start there, apply from scratch. I said, Ma, I'm like, I need to finish school. I'm like, I need to finish this high school. I was at grade 9 or 10. I don't remember exactly the grade, but I knew that if I finished, I had some sort of diploma. That's all that mattered to me at the time. GED diploma. And so she says, no, we have to go because I feel like something's going to happen, because we started noticing that few refugees disappeared from refugee camp. We don't know where they went, what happened. They just vanished. And a week later from that conversation, I said to my mom, no, I want to study. I want to wait. I want to finish my education. I was also a member of a soccer team. I was playing some championships. I was involved. And then that one day, 4 a.m., police knocks on the door. I don't know who they are, what they are. They have some order, and it says Abschiebung, which is deportation. I read this, and I'm shocked. My mom says not to open the door, because I try to open the door. I hear Abschiebung, Polizei, and she says, run. I try to run, but we had a window, and they were already by the window, and I'm like, okay, I'm trapped. We're trapped. So we had to open the door. We're opening the door. He says an order. This is order from immigration. You are no longer refugee here. We're deporting you. You're illegal. And this is despite the fact that the lawyer promised that all these weekly visas are okay, everything. It was all scam from attorneys. There was a separate topic where attorney wanted to sleep with my mother. I'm not gonna go there, but the system is so filthy, and it took advantage of my mother at the time. I mean, it just, so the policemen take over our little two rooms. We had two rooms, giving us 15 minutes to pack. My mom doesn't know where things is. She's completely lost. She is such bewilderment, and I'm not understanding. And my sister there, she's already 8 years old. She yells to me in German, she's like, Ali, what's happening? I said, and I feel the guilt. I feel like it's me. It's because of me, because I could have saved this. We could have gone. But everything was happening so quick. And one of the policemen shoved my mom, like, you know, like, schnella, beweg dich, like, move. And she hit the guy with the elbow. The policeman just put her down, locked her up in handcuffs, and threw her in the back of the van. And she's screaming, Ali, Ali, help me, I'm in pain. There was my grandmother's necklace. Find it. I couldn't find any of that. I don't know. She lost everything. The only thing I remember, I had some savings, 300 euros. I put it in my underwear. And that's it. All clothes, everything, whatever I could put, was put in a backpack. And then we were put in the back of the van. My sister, it was just... My mom was so devastated, and I felt the pain. I felt it's just me. She did it for us. I ruined her life. And we're just sitting there in the back of the van. And the van brought us to Frankfurt. My sister was just, I don't know what was she going through. And they took us into this little detention camp, like where they put the refugees that violated something, like criminals. Like we were criminals, we didn't do anything. And then they were searching me. Thankfully, they didn't find any money, nothing. They didn't care. And they just put us in the back of the plane. They made this entrance at the back of the plane. Everybody on the plane looked at us that we were some criminals. And on the flight, I remember my mom was just screaming, Ali, Ali, you ruined it. We could have been in France. We could have been elsewhere. We could have been. So I'm arriving to Ukraine. And my mom had to, because there were no passports, there was nothing. Nothing. The Ukrainian government found my mom in the system. She's a traitor. She left. She was searched. They took her necklace. They took whatever she had, the belongings, necklace. They're like, you're nobody here. You're nobody. They searched me. They didn't find anything. At that point, I was just so devastated. They saw me. They didn't even touch me. They interrogated my mom, like, what do we have in Germany? Do we have anything, money? Do we have any real estate? Nothing. So we come to Ukraine, nothing. And at the airport, my mom was able to ask someone for a telephone. This was year 2003. Year 2003. I am 15 years old. My sister is 8. And my mom is in her 40s. She calls my sister. My sister is in shock. She's like, wow, are you in Ukraine? She sent somebody to pick us up, a friend. So we waited at the airport for hours and hours and hours. And then our friend picked up and brought us back home, brought us back to the apartment that my mother, we still had an apartment. Someone else was just living there, my sister's friends. So we had to co-live with them for a little bit. And it felt like nightmare. It didn't feel real. that moment was the most, in my mom's life, I know it was the most devastating. So we come home, we settle in, and every day I tried to stay calm, but every day I felt the guilt because it was intense. Mom was paralyzed. We started having neighbors that came to us and bring alcohol to mom, so we started drinking. That caused more violence at home. All violence was just inflicted upon me. And I felt there's got to be a way.
Thank you for joining me in experiencing Ali's story thus far. Please make sure that you find him on social media now and send him all kinds of love. His links are in the show notes. And keep an eye out. The next chapter of Ali's story will be released in just 2 days. If you are enjoying this series, please share, rate, review, and subscribe. I am sending you so much love, and I'll see you soon. Thank you.